Coming up, the Pope's radical message in Brazil. Also, Kim Lawton reports on the Sikh American community 1 year after a mass shooting inside a Wisconsin temple that killed 6 worshipers. And Bob Faw on the varied contemporary creations of Orthodox Jewish artist Toby Kahn. He says his work can help bring peace to people at the end of their lives.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Pope Francis traveled to Brazil for World Youth Day this week, his first international trip since becoming Pope in March. Large crowds greeted the Pope throughout the week as he emphasized his familiar themes of humility and concern for the poor. Nearly a million pilgrims attended the welcoming ceremony on the Copacabana beach in Rio de Janeiro. Earlier in the week, Francis celebrated Mass at the Shrine of Our Lady of Aparecida, and he met with patients at a drug rehabilitation facility. The Pope also visited a Rio slum, a favela, where he urged people living there not to lose hope. For more on the Pope's trip, I'm joined by Father Tom Reese, senior analyst for the National Catholic Reporter and a visiting scholar at Santa Clara University. He joins us from California. Tom, welcome. The Pope is quoted as having told young people in Brazil that he wants a mess. He wants trouble in the dioceses. What's going on?
Well, this is a Pope who has really brought excitement to the church. This is a Pope who is a Pope of poor people, of the slums, and now of young people, and he wants to have a revolution. He wants people to recognize that the gospel of Jesus is revolutionary. It's call for concern for the poor. It's call for mercy and compassion. It's call for forgiveness. This is, I think, an exciting message which he's been able to articulate, and I think it's one that the young people in Brazil really found attractive.
Does the Pope have a kind of political agenda, some kind of political or policy or economic program to go along with the call for making a mess?
Well, I think that what the Pope has is a prophetic message, a message that says people have to turn away from selfishness, turn away from corruption, and that the people who have power and wealth in the world have to be concerned about the poor. He talks about solidarity with the poor. Now, this is a revolutionary prophetic message. It has political consequences. Now, he doesn't have an economic plan. He doesn't have a budget. He's not going to say how this should be done, but he's going to hold people's feet to the fire and say, this is your job. This is what you have to be concerned about. This is what I want you to do.
There, it was some decades ago, there was liberation theology that was very popular in Latin America. Is this an outgrowth of that?
Well, people in Latin America who are liberation theologians say that he may not use the word, but he certainly talks the talk. His concern for the poor, his desire to empower the poor to take responsibility and to be part of the community. This is very important for him. He doesn't use the word liberation theology, but his message is very close to it.
But is he socialist? Many liberation theologians were Marxist. It's not that, is it?
No, not at all. No, he would reject Marxism. He would reject any turn to violent revolution. What he wants is a peaceful revolution. He wants a revolution of love, of compassion, of concern, where people's hearts are changed. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this change of heart, we have new programs that help the poor, that get jobs for all these young people who are unemployed. And this is the kind of revolution he wants.
And in the process, do something about the huge growth there's been in recent years of Catholics, former Catholics, becoming evangelical Protestants.
Well, I think he's recognized that the evangelicals have been successful because they've been preaching the gospel. We tend to teach people the catechism instead of teaching them about Jesus and about the gospel message of compassion, of love, mm-hmm. of justice. This is what people find attractive, especially young people. It's going to be scary for some old people and for some people who, you know, want to hold on to their wealth and their power. He's saying that this has to be shared with the people, with especially the poor.
Father Tom Reese, many thanks. In other news, prayer services were held in Spain this week for the more than 75 people who died in a train crash near the city of Santiago de Compostela, the site of a popular Catholic pilgrimage. Many of them were traveling to the city to celebrate the feast day of St. James the Apostle, whose bones are said to be buried in the cathedral there. In Washington, evangelicals gathered to pray and call once again for comprehensive immigration reform. Evangelical leaders have been lobbying Congress to pass legislation that both secures the border and provides a pathway to citizenship. At a press conference on Capitol Hill, they said immigration reform is a matter of moral urgency.
We're here as a group of believers in Jesus Christ who want to let our elected officials know that we're praying for them. We're praying for wisdom, we're praying for discernment, and we're praying for justice and for compassion in a system that is broken.
Also in Washington, faith groups renewed calls to close the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. Religious leaders fasted for 24 hours in advance of a Senate hearing on the possibility of closing the base. As they broke the fast, they described Guantanamo as, quote, an open moral wound.
The practice of torture, the degradation of human beings in body, mind, and spirit, runs counter to our calling for a more just, compassionate, and peaceful world that honors all of God's creation.
August 5th marks the one-year anniversary of a mass shooting during Sunday services at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. White supremacist Wade Michael Page killed 6 worshipers and wounded 4 others before killing himself. Kim Lawton spoke with Sikhs, or Sikhs as many prefer to call themselves, about how they move beyond the tragedy with a new sense of identity and hope.
At Camp Grimaud in Rockville, Maryland, Sikh American kids from across the country have come to learn about their faith and their heritage. Rajwant Singh of the Sikh Council on Religion and Education is one of the organizers.
The whole focus of the camp is to really prepare these youngsters to become so connected with the heritage and so much connected with the history that they don't feel any sense of inferiority when they go out in the world.
Ready, set, go!
That can be a difficult message when Sikh Americans in many areas continue to face discrimination and misunderstanding. Because of their turbans and beards, Sikh men are often mistaken as Muslims. Since 9/11, attacks against Sikhs have risen sharply, culminating on August 5, 2012, with the mass shooting of worshipers at prayer in Oak Creek, Wisconsin.
I think that in the years after September 11th, The tragedy was just how normalized racism had become, so much so that when Oak Creek happened, it was devastating, it was demoralizing, but for many it wasn't a shock.
The close-knit Sikh American community, which numbers about 500,000, felt the massacre deeply.
Well, we felt that all the bullets which were fired at the Sikhs and in the temple, they all hit our hearts.
But 1 year later, Sikhs across the board say good has come out of the tragedy.
the legacy of Oak Creek is not one of bloodshed, not one of tragedy, but how a community rose to bring people together, to heal, and to organize for lasting social change.
Valerie Kaur is a filmmaker and director of the interfaith group Groundswell at Auburn Seminary. Her family came to America 100 years ago. She says her first reaction to news of the shooting was despair. Then her phone started to ring.
People from all different colors and faiths were reaching out to me personally to tell me that they were with us. And this happened across the country. There was an outpouring of love and support that the Sikh community had never experienced before.
Numerous interfaith vigils and special events were held in solidarity with the community. It was a source of encouragement for Sikhs, but also an opportunity to educate people about their religion. Many Sikhs say the Oak Creek tragedy drew them closer to their faith, especially to the teaching that they must maintain a spirit of charikala, of optimism and hope. Valerie Kaur made a film about Oak Creek. She was there when they reopened the Gurdwara, or temple, after the shooting.
When the FBI handed over the Gurdwara to the community, when it was still a crime scene, when there was still blood in the carpets, when there were bullet holes in the walls, when the glass in the windows was shattered, and the community didn't wait a moment before they turned on the prayers and to the sound of Sikh prayers began to clean up and rebuild the Gurdwara before my eyes. I saw the spirit of Dardikla, this everlasting hope and optimism in the community that day.
She says she was also profoundly moved by how the Oak Creek Sikhs responded to the killer.
The whole community gathered together in order to pray, and they named each person who was killed in the tragedy, prayed for each of the victims, and then they named the gunman. And we as a community prayed for the soul of Wade Michael Page. And I think in that moment, I, as a young Sikh American woman, felt myself deeply connected to a faith tradition that responds to the most egregious atrocities with the spirit of love.
Leaders say since the shooting, there's a new sense of identity in the community.
A lot of young people and a lot of Sikhs have come out more stronger because they felt that this is the time my community needs me.
Young campers here say they take pride in being a Sikh.
I'm actually really proud of my religion, so every time I see somebody, I'll tell them that I'm a Sikh, and I'll tell them what Sikhs are all about.
Others, like 15-year-old Harnoor Singh, try to combat bullying at school and counter the kids who call him Osama.
If you don't tell them right there that, no, I'm actually not a Muslim, I'm a Sikh, this is what we believe in, this is who we are, and we're in no way affiliated with any terrorist group, that ignorance just keeps spreading and eventually you have every Sikh kid getting made fun of.
Sita Singh.
On the national level, the Sikh Coalition and other groups began a campaign to have the government specifically include Sikhs in U.S. hate crime statistics.
I remember standing with the police chief in Oak Creek as he hunched over the hate crime report form that he was obligated to fill out for the federal government. He showed me the report form and said, there's no way for me to check off the deaths that happened down the street. There is no category for me to count the lives of Sikh Americans who were murdered. This must change.
45 days after the massacre, Harpreet Singh Sahni, whose mother was among those killed, became the first Sikh ever to testify before the U.S. Congress. He urged the government to track hate crimes against Sikhs, Hindus, and other minorities.
I want to combat hate, not just against Sikhs, but against all people. Senators, I know what happened at Oak Creek was not an isolated incident. I fear it may happen again if we don't stand up and do something.
That law was finally passed in June. Now the Sikh community has a new campaign, urging the U.S. military to change its 1980s policies, banning service members from wearing turbans or uncut hair. Major Kamaljeet Singh Khalsi spent 2 years getting an exception to the rule. He served as a doctor in Afghanistan and earned a Bronze Star.
I can tell you with 100% assurance that none of my fellow soldiers or patients could care less that I was wearing a turban or a beard while I was treating their wounds. All that mattered was that whether I was an asset to the mission.
Sikhs have a long military tradition. Khalsi says for observant Sikhs, having a turban and unshorn hair are part of their religious uniform.
cutting one's hair is equivalent to adultery, you know. So it is really a fundamental part of who we are. And, you know, just as you would not expect anybody to, say, cheat on his wife in order to get into the military, you cannot also expect somebody to cut their hair or lose their turban.
Khalsi fashioned his own turbans, which allowed him to meet military requirements for helmets. Two other Sikhs have also received accommodations to serve, but hundreds of others have not. Khalsi says changing the rules will have an impact beyond the military.
If the military can say no, what happens is police, fire, you know, EMS, all first responder agencies can say, you know what, military can say no, so we're also going to say no. And we have seen that.
Service is an important part of the Sikh faith, and to commemorate the one-year anniversary of Oak Creek, many Sikhs have planned special days of service.
You can come to us with any problem and we will help you. We will willingly help you, and that's our duty as a Sikh. That is the duty for every Sikh. And in that way, we shouldn't be judged by how we look, but how we act as Sikhs.
Many Sikhs say those traditions and beliefs have helped their community move beyond Oak Creek with confidence and strength.
Even though we still face profiling and bullying and racial slurs and continued hate violence, despite all of this, I still have deep hope because I look to the resilience and the courage embodied in our young people. And I know that this generation, like generations before it, will carry on the banner of Jardi Kala, the Sikh spirit and the American spirit, for years to come.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
We have a report from Bob Faw today on an Orthodox Jewish artist in Long Island City named Toby Kahn. His work is contemporary and eclectic, glazed wooden blocks, synagogue murals, small flowers. It may seem too abstract for some tastes, but for Kahn, his work reflects the spiritual journey, very much including the power of art to help bring peace to people at the end of their lives.
The brushstrokes are deft, every shade of color precise, every blemish refinished, perfected.
I love it looking like a sky. I like the way it moves in and out. You see, this is a little darker, that's a little lighter.
In his Long Island City, New York studio, cluttered with a forest of wooden blocks, power tools, paints, and brushes, Toby Kahn creates paintings and sculptures, furniture, and large installations. He came to prominence when, in 1985, his work was selected for a group show at the Guggenheim Museum. But even though it's a small part of his work, Kahn is also known for his spiritual art and what he calls his sacred objects, like this ceremonial box.
Once a year, and you open it, and you let all your negative thoughts disappear.
Toby Kahn, the child of Holocaust survivors and an observant Orthodox Jew, creates Jewish art like this adornment for a Torah and this Omer counter, whose blocks mark the 49-day period between Passover to Shavuot.
And why gold?
I believe that your soul is gold. I believe everybody's inside is pure. I hope it is.
The Healthcare Chaplaincy, an organization that provides spiritual counseling and support for people who are ill, is putting up a new building in New York. Kahn is doing the artwork. This Omer counter will hang on the wall of the chaplaincy. After hours and hours of sanding and more layering of paint, the installation will be transformed to a much lighter tone.
I think this concept is wonderful. It incorporates so many elements of our various religious traditions, and yet it has an art that transcends all of that as well.
That is why the president of the chaplaincy, the Reverend Walter Smith, says he chose Toby Kahn as their artist because Kahn's work takes people to another place.
You have to believe that God moves through the artist in the way that God moves through a writer or a poet or whatever. What I think his art does for those who view it, that people come to it at a place in their journey and it takes them to where they need to go in that process of discovery. It is a transcendent experience. It takes you from here to wherever.
Khan, who describes himself as a spiritual rather than a religious artist, says beauty is inextricably linked to holiness.
There's a saying that, you know, everyone is in selam elokim. We are created in the likeness of God. I believe in that. And I when I see something beautiful, something happens to me. And I would call that a holiness. And I want my work to do that.
He started painting what is called end-of-life art 8 years ago when his mother was dying of pancreatic cancer. She had loved flowers, but as she weakened, she could no longer stand their smell.
I brought in one drawing that I had that was a flower painting. She loved that. And then I subsequently brought more and more images in of flowers. And she said she loved looking around the room and seeing life. It really influenced me in a deep way. And then after she died, I decided this is something that I could do in her memory.
Khan's flower paintings hang in the hallways of the Zicklin Hospice in Riverdale, New York. His water and sky paintings in the patients' rooms. Sally Kaplan is with the United Jewish Appeal.
You know, nature and artwork and the whole environment have a positive impact on someone who's ill or at end of life. When you see scenes from nature, there's almost a oneness that comes about, that somehow that this is a circle that's going to be completed. And so I think it helps with that level of acceptance and that understanding that this is a natural process of life.
That simple gift to his mother has evolved into a demand for his end-of-life art. Like all his work, it is a labor-intensive process. Khan uses layers and layers of gesso and modeling paste and paint. To ensure a smooth finish, there are also layers of glaze. How long does it take him?
I come up with something, I think of it, and I think, like, how am I going to show this to the world? And sometimes it takes 3 years, sometimes it takes 10 years.
For the 61-year-old Khan, the objects he creates are meant to celebrate divinity. All this, he says, comes from the Hebrew word avodah, where work is combined with worship.
I don't believe that I do this work on my own. I believe there's something much larger than me. That I believe in God, so I believe it's God. But whatever it is, I definitely believe when I'm working, there's something else going on.
The painter, the icon painter, prays every day over those pigments, prays over the brushes. You're called to do something. And not every painter sees this. And that's why painters that do this kind of work see their life and their mission.
Khan's work doesn't preach. He isn't trying to impose his beliefs. And if someone who sees his work comes away with an impression entirely different than what Toby Khan had in mind, that, he says, is perfectly all right.
I want the viewer to bring his or her own experiences to the conversation.
Khan uses the same approach, not just in single objects, but for large installations like this 9/11 memorial, the paintings in this Milwaukee synagogue, his Holocaust memorials, and the chapel at the Zicklin Hospice. Here, he created the furniture, designed the seating area, and chose the textures and colors of the whole installation. For people approaching the end of life, his work is designed to bring comfort and peace.
Toby, I think, uniquely has a sense of how to put what is in his soul, there's a Hebrew word, neshama, to use that soul and bring it forth and put it in a visible form of a painting or a sculpture.
Kaplan says Toby Khan's work helps people who are dying heal.
You don't normally think of healing at end of life, because we think of healing as physical healing. But in fact, healing can happen at the end of life, and it's very profound, it's very deep. And it's coming to terms, maybe with your family members, and it's developing a sense of peace about yourself. And I think Toby's art is all about peace and that journey to finding that place of peace. And that's very, very relevant to people at the end of life. That's what all of us hope for our loved ones.
And that feeling of peace is exactly what Toby Khan is trying to achieve back there in that cramped, chaotic studio where he puts in 12 to 14-hour work days.
When you see something that touches you, you can enter the painting. I want my work to be that aid to take you on that journey.
To that sacred space?
To that sacred space, to the place that brings one comfort.
Toby Khan's work, as one writer put it, is anchored among earthly things, but pointing endlessly upward. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faux in Long Island City, New York.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website where you can watch longer interviews on the anniversary of the Sixth shooting at Oak Creek. And you'll also find a link to more of artist Toby Khan's work. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes of Pope Francis in Brazil.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.